This week's story comes with a language warning for those of you who may be listening in the presence of children or anyone offended by the F word in general conversation. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? Well, they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Speaking of stories, today's conversation is with someone who understands at a lived and visceral level just how deeply children are shaped by what they observe. Not by what we say, but how we show up. Ricky Longshore hosts the podcast Humans Like Us and is someone who has lived several very different lives. From nightclub doors to railway locomotives, classrooms to coaching young people through some of their hardest moments. The common thread through all of this has always been people, listening to them, sitting in the mess, and staying present until the truth shows up. His work today is grounded in a simple but powerful purpose, helping young people see themselves clearly before the world tries to tell them who they are. Ricky doesn't preach or pretend to have all the answers. Instead, he's bringing the lessons he learned the hard way, shaped by early responsibility, loss, and the patterns he had to consciously unlearn. Hello, let's start at the beginning. How would you describe your childhood?
Look, my childhood is unique to me, but not uncommon. So I grew up with an alcoholic mother. She had many of her own demons. I'm the youngest of four that lived in that house. So I've got a couple of brothers and a sister, and I was the baby. So I probably missed a lot more, but we grew up in a house, it was dire a lot of the times, in all ways, financially, emotionally. And we grew up with extreme domestic violence in our house. We grew up around people whose answer to respect was fear, violence, drugs, just everything you can imagine that you wouldn't want a child to live in. We lived in it, you know, from months there where my mum had to make the decision between, you know, electricity or gas, you know, those kind of scenarios where sometimes it was no lights in the house and we lived by candles, and then sometimes it was no hot water and everyone just had bars because we could heat the kettle up 57 times and chuck it in the bath. So look, as a young person, that's sort of where I grew up. I knew that was never going to be my life. I had something inside me that I identify now. And I remember being, you know, a small kid knowing that this wasn't the way I was going to live. So at around 10 years old, I went to live with my dad. It was sort of the first time where I got to be a kid. You know, food wasn't scarce. Love wasn't scarce. It was safe to sleep at night, those sort of things. So yeah, for my young life, that was sort of the precipice. And then I got like a bunch of really good years with my dad. And then in between year 11 and 12, my dad passed away really suddenly. So I was sort of 16 years old and then just by myself. So that was my childhood in a nutshell. It was sort of really chaotic. And then I got a little bit of a handle on it. And then that sort of got all taken away again.
Well, it's good you can laugh about it now. When you were talking about what your experience was like, my heart broke for that little boy in you.
Yeah.
And I understand because, you know, my little girl needs a big hug sometimes as well, not to that degree, but the trauma is real and it's more common than we realise. You talk about that and patterns that are formed through that type of upbringing. It's something I've spoken with Bryn Edwards about in season one of this podcast, but what patterns did you inherit that you've had to let go or work through?
Look, there's a few things that have become incredibly apparent to me. One, and this is why I do what I do that feels so important to me, is I started looking for role models where at a time when I was, you know, 15, 16 and my dad was sick and then, you know, subsequently passed away, I craved someone to look after me, right? And I craved that role model. So I went looking for it in places where I reverted to a childlike state almost, where I strength was violence and fear and loud and aggressive. So I, as a 16-year-old kid, that's immediately where I reverted to. So I become aggressive and violent and all these sort of things, trying to, I can see it now, protect myself in you know, such an uncertain time. So I see that. I see my my absolute need for approval from older men. I've had that my whole life, looking for that father figure that left. So, you know, you look at my friends now, and I've got a handful that are my age, but the majority of my friends are 10 years older than me. It's just the way it is, always been. And it's a real funny little pattern that I can identify now. The other thing I think that I see quite prevalent in my own life is my absolute ability to carry everything by myself and need no help. And just because, again, it's me looking after me, and it's always been that way. So yeah, that's probably the three big wins that I've had as a result of my life so far.
It sounds like there's been a lot of work in there. What type of counselling or therapy or even mentoring got you through those years?
Yeah, look, I don't know what really got me through those years, other than that I mentioned before, that innate desire to not be the person that was around me when I was younger. So I, you know, through all the things that I, all the situations I managed to get myself in, I always held a self-belief that I was better than that. So I carried a lot of myself through that. Getting older now, like working in this space, to get to this space, you have to confront a lot of those things. So a lot of therapy, a lot of counseling. You know, I'm lucky that my best friend, Jasmine, she's studied psychology, and she's been my friend since high school. So I'm lucky to have her when it all goes to shit, that I can call her up and we can really unpack some things. So she's been an incredible help, probably greater than she ever knows. But yeah, look, there's been a lot of work in that space. I used to think that I even, probably the way I just said it then, that I carried myself through a lot of this, but there's a lot of key people have shown up in my life at the right time. So I'm very grateful for those, you know, those little sparks that show up and keep me accountable and keep me honest, I think is probably the easiest way. Like, not like good people, good men are not afraid to tell me to pull my head in and really like tell me to look at what I'm doing, and is this, you know, in my best interest?
My audience can't see you, but you're a big, burly bloke covered in tattoos with facial hair and a buzz cut, right? So that should give people an image of you. How challenging was it, looking and being the way you are, especially being an aggressive man as well, to have to ask for help?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting way to put it. I don't think I really wanted help, if I'm being completely honest. Like, deep down, sure, there was a wound that couldn't be filled, right? And it's probably really prevalent with all men. We get told so often that we just, you know, man up and just deal with shit and work through it. So yeah, look, honestly, I don't think I was ever really crying out for help, because we just weren't programmed that way back then. And you know what? That sort of comes at the expense of realizing that enough is enough, and getting to that absolute bottom of the barrel point where, okay, this isn't serving me anymore. We need to do something, instead of maybe that proactive shit slowly getting out of hand. We need to grab a hold of it before we get to the bottom. So yeah, something that I am still working on to this day, nearly 40 years old. So.
Well, I'm wondering how this big, burly, biker-looking guy who worked at nightclubs and on railway locos ended up coaching in classrooms. That must be the most interesting part of your story for me.
Look, it is an interesting story. So Lived Health, you know, my business partner, Paul, I set up a monthly coffee date for men, essentially, so blokes could catch up and have a coffee. You know, I very rarely drink these days. So I wanted to organize something in the community for men to catch up and do something that didn't revolve around alcohol, especially in Australian culture, incredibly a huge part of it. So I managed to get a group of essentially just my friends together, all connected to me, not really connected to each other. And we had about six of us show up for the first one. During that week leading up to that, a young man that went to high school with my oldest daughter, he would have been 20 at the time, committed suicide. This was the second person in his family to do so. His 14-year-old brother went earlier that year. So this is two suicide deaths in my community, in the same family. At the time, my youngest daughter was 13 years old. So very similar ages to my kids. And we got talking about it at this coffee catch up. You know, we sort of all fathers, everyone that showed up was a father that day. And we quite open and honestly started having discussion around mental health in our kids, in our community, in schools. And we got to the point where I asked the question, I was like, when is enough enough? Like, what is happening in this space? Like, why isn't more being done? And then it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks that we can all sit there and ask why more isn't being done. But unless someone steps up to do something, like, nothing's going to change. So, yeah, I sort of mentioned that at the end. It was like this 5 minutes towards the end. I was like, fuck it. You know what? I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to figure out how to do it, how to get in front of these kids and have yarns with them. So that was pretty much how it started. Then my business partner, Paul, he knows, he's one of those people that just knows everyone. So he texts me after this thing and he's like, I'm in, let's figure it out. And, you know, within a month, he's got a friend that's a deputy principal and all these sort of things. So within a month, we had a pilot program in place and, you know, we got to sort of really start to sharpen that skill. So yeah, so I was just super lucky to have Paul on board and get a program in place.
As a father, knowing the patterns that were created in you through your upbringing and through the modeling that was set for you by your parents, how has that changed the man you are as a father, given that you talk about patterns worth passing on and ones you'd rather they grow out of?
My girls are my absolute world. I'm very grateful. So my oldest is her birthday today, actually. My stepdaughter, so she's in Japan, she's living it up. She is 7 years older than my youngest. So there's two very different ages there. And I'm really grateful that I get to do sort of both levels at the same time. But our house is like bullshit free. Like, we talk about anything and everything all the time, and we foster really great discussions around mental health, relationships, and like friendships. And we talk really openly about mental health. And, you know, we've had the crisis talks, and we've had the cutting talks, and the alcohol and drug abuse talks, and we've had them really open and honestly. And we don't judge, like, because I've lived it. Trust me. If the kids are talking about doing it, I've done it twice. And them seeing that and not being judged, but more being guided. And look, kids are going to do what kids are going to do. You know that. I know that. They know that. They're going to smile in your face and do it anyway. So I think having like really safe and non-judgmental spaces for them to discuss ideas and thoughts and really work through stuff is super important. And you know, that's the cornerstone of the way we coach as well, where you know, we're in a really privileged position to not be these kids' parents or teachers. We're this third party of dudes that just care, and that's really genuine, and the kids feel that. The kids are, you know, really receptive when men care about them. We've lost that, right? It's the supermarket thing. It's the teacher thing. It's you know, when I grew up, I had Uncle so-and-so and Uncle so-and-so and this guy and that guy in my life that were just friends, just, you know, these little mentor waystones. And kids are losing that because we're, you know, as a society, we're so afraid of the man next door.
And it's not just boys that need that male role model either. It's the girls too. And having been a sole parent and having lost the man who was that role model for my children, not a very good one, but anyway, let's move on. I understand the hole that leaves, particularly for a girl. My girl's the eldest, and they go looking to try and replace it just as you did. But unfortunately for a girl, that usually is a sexual encounter. You know, so raising kids with the full knowledge, having experienced it, is one thing. But, you know, you still talk, even recently, about reactions you might have in the car and how your children may view that through a different lens. So has having those open discussions helped in them understanding you and why you might snap like that at someone in the car?
I think that my kids understand me far greater than I give them credit for. Which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but my kids like will never wonder why I am the way that I am, if that makes sense. Like, they know my story inside and out. Maybe they don't appreciate it fully to the depth, and that's okay. They will one day. I don't think that my story is a great enough catalyst for shitty behavior, right? Like, it's just a story. So, like, I'm very aware that we can explain it all away. It's funny, right? So growing up, driving was like the best thing for me. It was freedom, and I could get in the car, and, you know, and it was my happy place. I would, like, as a kid, when I first got my license, just drive hundreds of kilometers in one direction, turn around and come back. As I've gotten older, driving has become this really high stress environment. And I have no idea why. I don't know what that stems from. There's no car accident, nothing like that. But so now my driving style is I'll be singing the line of a song, and then, excuse me, listeners, it'll be, oh, this fucking idiot, and then straight back into the song, right? So my kids, but it does get extreme. And in this scenario that I spoke about there, the post that you're referring to, it was this moment where, I don't know, yeah, maybe my kids see me less as a dad in that moment, and maybe she just see me as like an angry man. And there's, you know, that shift, and that when you are aware of yourself and that, you know, you can feel it. And then there's been 100 situations like that as a kid where an angry man doesn't even realize that, you know, it's affecting people in the room. So, yeah, I think there was a sort of, a realization in that moment, like, holy shit, that was a sliver of that angry man that doesn't even know that he's being angry to someone that I love so much. So, yeah, it was this real, like, oh, holy shit, like, it's just mindless road rage to me, and it's contained in this car, but sometimes it's not just me alone in this capsule of anger.
And I think that might be where some of your driving habit changes may have come from, because you're now responsible for another life. So when someone cuts you off, it's actually more dramatic, because you go into protection mode. It's not just about you. It's about the person who's the passenger with you. And this is something I can identify with. I mean, I was a road rager. I know it's hard for you to believe. And I was just talking about this recently with somebody else, but I love the way that you actually share these stories with the intent to help people understand they're not alone. You know, this is why I do this podcast. This is what it's all about. So why have you sort of pivoted and taken this focus on sharing these tips and techniques that are so personal to you?
Like I said before, with my life story, it is unique to me, but it's not uncommon. And there's threads that are in my life story that are in everyone's life story. The part that I have really pivoted into LinkedIn, and you'll see that all of my posts generally end with a question and require input or ask for input. They don't get it all the time, but it's because we can all have the best intentions, and unless we all get off the couch and actively, you know, engage in our community for the better, I don't think that we're allowed to complain about it. If we're not all willing to stand up and help the next generation, you know, we don't get to complain that they're all playing too much Xbox if we're not going to take them out camping. I don't think that we get to complain that they're really antisocial if no one's teaching them the social skills. So, yeah, I know for myself, this is an I statement, but it is so common, is when men have responsibility, they are their best versions. We are providers of service. That's what we do. Acts of service is every man's love language at their core. And when they really engage with the intention of making the next generation better, they are the absolute best versions of themselves. Whether they have the skills and tools to do it at a commercial or corporate or, you know, school level, or if it's just being a better uncle to their nephews, you know, these sort of things. So my posts generally are, here's how I do shit really badly. How can we make it better for the next one? What are you doing to make it better for the next one is generally the rhythm that I post with.
I just love it because that is the way we bring people in. And I heard someone say I think it was a TED Talk I was watching, and they were talking about how it was very funny. I should probably share the link with you if I can find it again. But they were talking about how each generation judges the younger generation, right? And they, what's wrong with kids these days? And he said, we're asking the wrong question. We should be asking, how can I support this generation with the tools they need? Share the wisdom and the knowledge that we have. So that's exactly what you're doing. You're exactly where you need to be. What's on the cards for you in 2026? How's your future looking?
So 2026, I would love to do more one-on-one coaching. So I work well with groups of kids. That's absolutely certain. But I think to really step into that next level is to really hone that one-on-one skill, take a lot more responsibility in helping some kids. So definitely more in the one-on-one space. My passion is with young men, obviously. You know, I've grown up to be the person that I needed, that incredible statement. But I definitely want to work more in the men's space as well. And I think that somewhere in that is a crossover. So think maybe like a father-son camp, or, you know, or have volunteer men come in for men at risk without role models, and sort of have those sort of that crossover, that mentored group in a retreat space. Yeah.
I can see it now. In fact, the minute you mentioned that, the crossover, I went father-son, because I was talking to a dad recently, and he's the dad of a grown man who's having troubles with his business and his relationship, who he's lost connection with, and even those father and son duos, because that's impacting that son's role of being a dad as well. So kudos to you.
Yeah, I think that we just need to give the boys a bit of a crack too, so that, you know, they aren't forgotten about, because for too long we've told them just to sort it out, and we see now that that doesn't work. They need guidance. They need love and care and respect and honesty, and yeah, they need to be brought along for sure.
Well, I am definitely on your team. Ricky Longshore, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing your personal story and looking into your journey thus far. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kim. It was great. You know, I was a bit worried that I wouldn't be able to articulate as well as your past guest.
That's Ricky Longshore imparting his wisdom about modelling behaviour and the quiet moments children absorb when we think no one is watching. The reactions, the resets, the integrity, and the accountability that get passed down without words. It's a gentle nudge that children don't need perfect adults, they need present ones. He's inviting us to reflect not just on how we raise children, but how we model adulthood. You'll find all the links to Ricky's podcast, Humans Like Us, and his work in the show notes. I encourage you to listen, reflect, and perhaps even ask yourself one quiet question. What am I modelling, even when I don't realise it? I'm Kim Clyden. Until we're together again, be kind to yourself. Tomorrow is another opportunity to do things differently.